What is a nation and what is a country? What's the difference? Welcome to this webinar organized by The Elephant in partnership with the Hendrik Boyle Foundation. My name is Mishai Mwangola. I'm a member of The Elephant Herd. I like to think of myself as one of the herd matriarchs, but on a serious note. So to help me answer these questions, I am joined by two great minds already. I want to start by introducing Oyunga Pala. Oyunga is a Kenyan writer. I guess he's best known for his newspaper columns, his blog, all of which have examined the texture of everyday Kenyan life and the challenges of modernity and disillusionment.
Thank you very much, Mishai.
We're also joined by Wandia Joya. Wandia is another matriarch in the Elephant Herd. She's a public intellectual who engages as a teacher and researcher, both in the academy and in the public sphere. I'm going to really enjoy seeing Dr. Ngala Chome. Ngala is a writer and a historian who recently completed his doctoral studies, and we're all very excited about that. So I'm going to just go straight into it. What is a nation and what is a country? What's the difference? Oyunga.
Yeah, I mean, for the longest time, especially when you live outside of Kenya, one of the first things that people always ask is, where do you come from? And you mention your country, right? And there's a certain pride about being from a certain country, especially as a Kenyan during the time of Olympics, with people like Eliud Kipchoge doing what they're doing. There's a certain pride that comes with that sense of nationalism. But when people ask you about your nation, as in what are the shared values, and you look at perhaps other Africans, other Kenyans in the diaspora, and you find that in terms of the kind of values that you wish to be associated with, are sometimes not always from your countrymen. Yeah? And you find that in a space of, say, in a diasporic space, you find that yourself, you start getting attracted to people who sort of share your own values. And you realize, when you look critically at your nation, you realize it doesn't quite hold some of the values that you wish to espouse. So I've learned to sort of create the distinction that, for me, I look at a nation as a very sort of recent entity and always a work in progress. And I tend to think of a country as more of a geographical location, the place from which we emerged. Yeah. That's the kind of distinction I create. Yeah.
Thank you very much, Oyunga. That's useful. Wandia?
I think I would make the same distinction that Oyunga made. Maybe just add that when it comes to nation, a nation is what we decide it is. It's a decision we make. And it's a decision we make through the values that we espouse, the interests that we have, and it has to be something that we keep affirming through ritual, through culture, through institutions. So it is something that we have to agree on and that we have to commit ourselves to keep renewing. The problem with Kenya is that I think there's a sense in which, as people, ordinary people, there's a sense in which we share a lot. We share, you know, cultural expressions like weddings, initiation. We love one another. We invite people into our homes. I think at that basic African level, we are a nation as Kenyans. We celebrate, for example, our athletes. But the state keeps interfering with those relationships and keeps distracting us, poisoning our relationships. So we lose sense of what really matters, and we tend to lose our ability to care for one another, so that whatever happens in one aspect of the geographical area, which I think is the country that we are responsible for, whatever happens in one side of Kenya, we don't really act politically in solidarity with them. So I would say that's the distinction is the decision that we make and the commitment that we make through cultural expressions. That's what makes a nation. And I think it's something we have to be more deliberate about if that's what we want. Because, you know, we could not want to be a Kenyan nation, and that's fine. But whatever we want, I think we have to be more deliberate about it and not let politicians whose interest is material and not human, we should not let them dictate what it means to be a nation.
Thank you, Wandia. I want to welcome Mungala.
Sante.
So what are your thoughts?
So thank you for having me. So in strict political science language, the distinction is usually made between the state and the nation, right? And therefore, well, the nation usually describing or referring to the community that could either, in terms of territory, be found within the boundaries of a state, in this case a country, or could even span the boundaries of a state as that exists as a legal entity, right? So nation is more the word nation describes a community. It refers more to the people. It refers more to their histories. It refers more to their culture, and a nation can exist without a state. And that is actually why those two concepts are seen as different. Now, state, of course, is in this case sort of a Western creation, particularly 1498 with the Treaty of Westphalia, where this kind of modern state system is agreed to, and it exists in international relations as a legal unit. It may actually contain many different nations within one state. And I think that this is the sort of, I don't want to see it as a problem, but it has been described as a problem when it comes to African politics. That you have states that were created by an inorganic colonial process that did not pay attention to sort of historical, cultural continuities within the continent. So that's how you find in most African states composed by different communities, different cultures, different languages. And that then becomes, as a historian of African history, Basil Davidson calls the curse of the African state. Now, then the question becomes, and I think Wandia has posed a question very well, do we want to become a state? Do you want to become a nation? You know, it's very clear that Kenya is a state. It exists in international universe as a legal entity. But it's not very clear whether we can talk of a Kenyan nation. So the question is that a problem? And if it's a problem, why? And if it's not a problem, then what's the problem, right, with our politics? You know, we are so used to thinking of what we call tribalism as sort of at the center of our country's politics. But if we were a nation, would we have solved many other problems that have affected our history? So if we did have a Kenyan nation, are we saying that would be equal to lack of corruption, lack of inequality, a country that is full of patriotic citizens? Is that what we are saying? I don't think these two things usually go together. However, in the political space, the way politicians talk about the importance of having a nation, it is always presented as the cure-all solution to most of the problems that bedevil our country's politics. So I want to start off with kind of posing those series of questions to take us through the discussion.
And indeed, Ngala, one of the things I really want to get to those questions to ask, you know, so as I said earlier, how does this help us put food on our table? What's the relationship between this? But before we go there, I just want to pick up on something that all three of you have said, that a nation is about the people. The country is about, you know, the space, the land where we all are. We are all in an entity that we imagine, you know, those people on the other side of this entity, of this geographical space that are governed by the same state, we somehow are related. And one question is, perhaps we don't want to be a nation. Perhaps we want to be, if you want, a federation of several ethnic nations or other kinds of nations that are all under one state. And some people have argued that that's what BBI is trying to do, is to say, listen, let's accept that we are different nations, and then let's have representatives of those nations negotiate over the state. And then the rest of us hopefully will get the benefits of it. So I want to ask, and you know, I'm really, really invested, probably, and this, you know, it's one of, let me say one of my favorite articles in the Constitution tells us that culture is the foundation of the nation. This is something we have agreed on. We as Kenyans have agreed on that the foundation of this nation is about culture. And culture is, of course, about people. So I want to think about what it means when we talk about people, and we talk about the state is about, you know, these frameworks that, you know, deliver to the people, the country is this geographical space. The nation seems to be something a little bit more intangible. And I want to suggest that when we talk about the soul of the nation, that's what we are talking about. And that's really hard to pin down, to define. So I'm going to, again, ask all three of you. I'm going to start with Wandia, because Wandia, I know you talk a lot about this thing called the soul. What does it mean to you when we talk about the soul of the nation? And then I'll come to Oyunga and Gala, so we just define our terms before we talk about what does this actually mean to all of us. Wandia, please.
For me, I feel our nation does not have a soul. The way we've defined Kenya and the way we have let the politicians manipulate our definition of Kenya, that definition has no soul. So what we are struggling for is actually a soul, and not even just the soul of Kenya, but the soul of being human beings and being Africans. And what our soul does is that it puts away the intangibles that you just mentioned, and it says, who are we and what's our bottom line? What are the things that we must do no matter what? You know, for me, care is one of them, that we must care for one another. Whatever happens in Garissa, in Narok, in Pokot, in Kwale, all those things should matter to us. And we should care about them as if it was our next door neighbor or our family. To me, that's soul, and that's what we don't have. That's what we are struggling so hard for. And I think, at least I would think, that the devolution was part of that. It was to say everybody in Kenya should be participating equally in their destiny, in the decisions that they make where they are, because we care. We care for everybody. And it's not to say I keep for myself, but it's to say we all take care of ourselves and take care of each other. I think that's the soul that we don't have and that we are still struggling for. I think there's a kernel in Kenyans. There's a small seed in Kenyans that is, you know, drowned by the noise of the political class and the state. And so I think what we are struggling for actually is our soul. We are trying to be human within these boundaries, but we are coming up against a lot of struggle and a lot of pushback. And I think that's what the BBI was about. I just also want to say that the other struggle that we have as human beings, especially since colonial rule, is the struggle to be social. You know, we were isolated and atomized into tribes. And the way tribes are spoken about in Kenya, it is not that this is an ethnic group on its own and it should be on its own. What those tribes do, from the definition of BBI, is to freeze us in time, so that whatever I do as an individual should not have any political or social impact beyond the self. And so what the BBI was trying to do is to atomize tribes, actually. They were not trying to say, let's have an ethnic federation. They were saying, let's atomize the tribes so that they don't talk to each other. And then the politicians, who I don't even know how they were appointed by money, capital, I don't know who appointed them. Then the politicians who get appointed, then they become our unelected representatives, kind of like kings. So they were not looking for an ethnic federation, even though that's what they were saying. They were trying to atomize us and separate us so that we are not politically and socially significant. And that has been the struggle of Africa since colonial times, to be able to have a voice that matters beyond ourselves and to be able to care for people who beyond us, beyond our immediate families. That's, to me, the one of the basic struggles we have right now.
I really like what you said about care, because again, as we said, care is about who I imagine to be human like me and who I imagine I have a responsibility towards, so that even if it means that my interests, I have to now begin to negotiate, giving up some of my own privileges or my own, in the interest of somebody like me who I have embraced as being part of my community, I am okay with that. And somehow there is this discussion on as to whether what BBI is telling us, as you have said, is that there are only certain people you can entrust to care for you. And they, so they must all have a share of the cake. You can't do it for yourself. And if I can send my representative there to negotiate with the state, I will be cared for. Otherwise, I cannot trust other people to care for me, and I should not have to care for the others. Thank you, Wandia. You said that you needed to think, but you've done very well, and always feel free to come back. May I come to Oyunga Ongala, who would like to go next?
I suppose
you guys can go.
I'll go for Ongala. Yeah. So, I mean, I'll just pick up on what Wandia said, off the back of a soul, and then looking at Kenya, and I'll sort of lean back into my frames, and I kind of look at this through a very anthropological way, and then skew towards a bit of masculinity, and it sort of sets me in the family unit. So I tend to think of a nation or a country from within the context of a family. And it's not that Kenyan itself doesn't have a soul, but it's what has happened to our soul. And so then I introduce the issue now of trauma. And I think part of our problem, and I follow Wandia's critique on education, and lately I noticed she's been talking about almost what you describe as a traumaphobic society, is that we refuse to just basically speak about our trauma. And we've got into this sort of very habitual pattern of depressing our traumas. And so it's like about pile and pile. And if there's ever a PhD higher, you know, higher and higher and deeper, of we just become experts at, and it's we even have a phrase for it, accepting and moving on, right? It just becomes sort of like almost a national way of being, in a way in which we have adapted our behavior in how we escape our own traumas. And so when you return trauma back into the sort of like the family unit, what happens when a child is traumatized? And what happens to their soul? So what they do is that they create a sense of behaviors, a new set of adaptations that deal with the sense of loss. And those behaviors could manifest as perhaps as addictions or excesses, or perhaps what we'd call bad citizens or bad behavior. And the nature then of the state, who then in this case represents sort of our sense of a parental figure, is to correct the behavior. And they only know one way. And Wandia talks about this at great length in terms of how the educational system is structured. It is to punish. It is basically, that is the only thing we know, is that there's a certain set of behaviors supposed to follow. And if you don't follow it, we're going to punish. And it's going to be pain upon pain. And so there's really no way out of it. So when you come back to the issue of Kenya's soul, or the soul of the nation, is that we really need to start talking about our own traumas and identifying them and literally poking into them in order to sort of get beyond them. And I think this is where we start, because we're very good at adapting to go beyond something. I think, and one of the perfect examples is that when you have generational conversations, those of us, for example, who went through the boarding school generation where bullying was a rite of passage almost, you know, you came into form one, you got sorted, you know, and by the time you got into form three, and that was a whole ritual, that was the way it supposedly hardened up. if you came up from families where it was quite normal for the bell to be reached out for a sleeper to come out, for things to be flung, that was ordinary violence. There was nothing unusual about it. So what happens to us then as parents is that since we didn't deal with those traumas, when our kids come to us, perhaps we know, okay, we're not supposed to apply violence, but a kid is coming for us with a very sort of emotional attachment need, and we're completely unable to give that because we never had it. So what do? We create another sense of adaptation, which creates even more separation, which is why now you see the separation between generations. When you look at the generation, I guess that would be the, I like to call the generation, okay, now, the millennials and the generation Zs compared with the X, which would be my generation, is we're completely at loss. We're unable to talk to each other. The relationship is completely broken. And so I think culturally, and this is what I think Kamkinte sort of captures beautifully in an article by referencing Peyton, the idea that, yes, colonialism broke us. It broke the tribe. And in many ways, the tribe, for all its complications, was a functioning moral system, right? And that's broken. And there are many ways in which we can never repair it, right? Because we, in a way, we've almost been reprogrammed in ways that are quite deep. However, if you reduce it back to the family unit, to the actual house, is that when your house isn't broken, the tragedy is not so much of the loss. The tragedy is the inability to try and even repair it. And I think that is where culturally, at least as from those of us who come from the artistic bend, for me, I think that becomes our core mission and core responsibility to be able to examine, to first of all come to the realization that we're dealing with a nation that's basically traumatized deeply at every level, at different levels, to the point of even if you really want to understand trauma in our country, just look at our politicians, a complete addiction to power and success. Right? It's a very temporary addiction. It provides a very temporary relief, returns into a cycle of pain, but they cannot come out of that cycle. And so if you don't understand what the trauma is and how it's sort of, it's passed down where, you know, you ask yourselves, why would a policeman brutalize to the point of death somebody for not wearing a mask? The easiest thing is just the police are evil, police are bad. But if you move away from that outrage and that sense of enrage, you ask yourself, what kind of pain is that man in to the point that just the very fact that a mask is displaced provokes that sort of anger? What kind of trauma did that policeman go through to express this kind of trauma repeatedly over and over and over again? What kind of pain is not so much why do police beat, is that how does this institution exist that this is the only way to cope with this problem? And those are kind of the questions we have to sort of start asking quite deeply and in sort of very artistic ways in terms of the kind of stories we tell about ourselves. Because if we don't, we continue to perpetuate and we're in a complete inability to help those who come after us. So what happens to our children? And this is what we used to say about the Walambese culture. It's a complete disassociation. And we fixate on the behavior that these kids are behaving bad. But as any parent knows, there's no such thing as a bad child. If you tell a child not to do something and they keep on repeating the same thing over and over again, who has the learning problem? You or the child? Because the child is acting out in a way, the actual word itself, acting out, is because they're unable to verbalize what they're feeling, so they act it out. So if we on the other side, from the point of authority, are inability to understand what is happening, what do we do? There's a relationship breakdown. The ways in which we can, one solution, and this is where Kankidi gets it right, is that in culture there is stories. And we can retell the stories about ourselves, and in that we can start actually mending our souls.
You know, I'm reading and I'm thinking about what you're saying, and I'm rereading Yvonne Awor's Dust and her call for us to engage with our trauma, with our history, before we can get to a place where you're able to start again, you know, to start again in the sense that you've dealt with what has happened to you, you've dealt with what's happened in the past, And then there is a new beginning that she, you know, she tells the story of how, in, you know, she uses dust as that book, Dust, and the story of this family as a metaphor for how we start again. How do we pull down the old house, if you want to speak, that's falling apart anyway, and then begin again in a new world. And I want to come to that question of how do we come as a consensus, to build consensus. But I think both of you are saying some really interesting things about this need for care and remembering always that we're dealing with trauma. And often, and I know one day you've written quite a lot about it, there's this way in which we blame each other, especially those people. Look at how badly they're behaving. Look at, you know, whatever, whether it's, you know, from the point of morality, instead of saying that, yes, what they're doing might be something we don't like, but let's look at why. And that doesn't make an excuse for what is happening. It is to say we are all implicated as part of this, and we cannot point fingers. Ngala, do you agree or disagree with what we are saying so far? And what would you bring into this question of, when we say the soul of a nation, what are we talking about?
There are two things that have been said that sort of really caught my attention. And one by Wandia and the other by Junger. I think Junger spoke about how the tribe was broken by the experience of colonialism. And Wandia spoke about the inability that we've had culturally to think beyond the family unit. So I don't want to misrepresent those views if this is what I heard. So I disagree with both views. One is because actually the existence of the tribe was the very evidence that people were able to think beyond the family unit, right? So the tribe existing as a kind of moral unit, it is a space in which, and I really don't want like to use this term, but it's a space in which people were able to come together and think about the world and think about the universe, right? And impart meaning onto the world, to give themselves names, to give themselves a language, and to give themselves an identity, a realization that without coming together, you could not make sense of your place in the world, but also you could not even conquer, especially the natural world. And to the other point that this thing we call the tribal unit was broken by colonialism. I don't think it was broken. It was redefined. It was reformed. It was the meaning of the tribe took on a different meaning because of colonization. Historians have always spoken about this idea of the super tribe. So when you think about the coming of identities such as the Kalenjin or the Mijikenda or the Luhya, you know, these are things that are taking place during the colonial period. And there's a direct relationship between that and the colonial experience itself, is that people are trying to think differently about identity because of the newness that was brought by the political economy of colonization. Then I would like to throw in this idea of moral ethnicity, which is written extensively about by John Lonsdale, and where he talks about how these communities were all composed with a distinctive ethnic moral language, right? So there was a very heavy language of responsibility. There's a very heavy language of civic responsibility, of taking care of each other as people of the same community. You find this not only amongst the Kikuyu imagination, but also the Luo people down the coast, that these ideas of taking care of each other, these are very kind of cherished African values that will be found in most of this kind of ethnic imaginations. What then happens, of course, is that when people begin to meet, and this is a process that was well curated by the colonial state, is that people are beginning to meet from these different communities across the territory, in the urban centers, right? So in places like Nairobi, in the civil service, in national schools, is that they already come with a very a strong base upon which they think of themselves and they think of their identity, so that the ethnic idiom became strong, in fact, much stronger than this idea that we are all citizens, but in that case, subjects of this colonial state called Kenya. So that in a very interesting way, I think in the way that Kenya develops in the post-colonial period, is that you find very strong ideas around ethnicity. So like you find very, very strong ethnic imaginations, but also at the same time, there's a developing of very specific national Kenyan experiences at the same time. So I think one needs to do a study to this day of how national schools, for example, if at all, shaped a sort of national consciousness, right? What it meant something to have gone to alliance, right? Despite your ethnic background, and a number of schools that we can mention. What does that mean when we think about a national Kenyan experience, right? An experience that is formed, for example, out of these schools. Outsiders looking in, even people from say the coast or northeastern, the idea behind speaking English, for example, also becomes a very nationalizing Kenyan experience in a way that it's not, for example, in Tanzania. And you can add there, trousers, Christianity, right? So these kind of values and these experiences, I think for me, begin to form a certain kind of Kenyan national experience that we have probably not really paid much attention to. But this is not to say that ethnic imaginations existed in opposition to these national experiences. So I think actually in Kenya, what we find is that you have a coexisting of ethnic languages, and in this case, very exclusionary ethnic imaginations coexisting with this very nationalizing Kenyan experiences that are formed by spaces or institutions that we have had to share just on the basis of being of sharing a territory here called Kenya. So I think we need to think about these other experiences. So it's not, for me, it's not a case of we are doomed, we don't have a nation, we don't have any national experience, and ethnicity is kind of the only way in which people can imagine community, can imagine identity. I think that there are many things going on here.
Mm-hmm. And so, can I
just clarify?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Go ahead, Nan.
I am not saying that ethnicity is rigid naturally. What I'm saying is that the state makes ethnicity rigid. It's the one that says you can only approach the state as an ethnic group. In fact, actually, what the state does, and this is what capitalism does also, it says you cannot enter the political economy except as an identity. And you know why they do that? They do that because identity is given. Usually, an identity is not something I decide. It's decided by where I was born, how I grew up. Those are not decisions I made. I didn't decide that I'm going to be born of the female sex, let me put it that way. So that's why capital likes identities, and it weaponizes identities. And in fact, I would suggest that even right now, they are weaponizing gender more than ethnicity, because gender, most of us, we come into it having it been decided for us. So what I meant was, what politicians do, it's not what the ethnic group does. What politicians do is that they rigidify our citizenship, and they tell us you cannot come into citizenship unless you're an ethnic group. So if I want to be as women, look at how women are trying to organize, through the two-thirds gender, and it's a problem. If I try to be any other identity other than ethnic, the state will clamp down on me, will make my life very miserable. Mm-hmm. And especially when it comes to work, because work is what gives us a sense of self. So they make sure they crush our creativity. They don't give us opportunities to extend our identity through our work. So that, for example, when you think of, let's think of the Makonde. The Makonde came here, they taught us carving skills. those should be Kenyans by virtue of that skill that they gave us. But no, they must be rigidified and stuck and not allowed to go beyond their identity. Also, we must not assume that our ethnic groups were not mingling before colonialism. They were. And we had different rituals and different ways of interacting with one another. We had names and languages that crossed over our ethnic groups. We are not being allowed that now. Mm-hmm. So what the problem isn't which identity we are. It's that we are not being allowed to transcend our identities. We are not being allowed to say, I'm ethnic, I'm gender, I am professional, I am this, I am this. All those identities as one, I should be able to bring them into the national space. That's what's being refused by the political class. And for a very simple reason, these guys can't work. Let me just be, you know, crude. Mm-hmm. They have no skill. They have no work. All they have is access to the state. And many of these families, especially the ones that we started to see coming under this current regime, were families who had grandparents who were colonial chiefs. So it is their access to capital and the colonial state that is making them go ahead. And because they have nothing to contribute to society, they tell us our only access is our identity because that's what we share with them. If we started to say, what have you done? What ideas have you come up with? What have you created? Where have you gone? They have nothing. And those are the things we Kenyans have across ethnic groups. We can share things we have done together, things we work, we run for this country, we act in movies. There's so many things that we've been doing. But when you look at who makes it to the top, it's not the people who have accomplished. It's the people who were born in the right families. Mm-hmm. So that's what I meant. I didn't mean that our ethnic groups were rigid. I meant that the state rigidifies them. And when Kenyans start to break out and say, I don't care, we're going to talk about healthcare no matter which ethnic group I come from as a doctor, what happens? You see the politicians coming in and saying, no, this union is being led by a certain ethnic group. They keep us, they refuse to let us transcend our identities. And I don't mean just ethnic. It's across any identity which we didn't have much choice in deciding. That's what politicians go for. Yeah.
So I want us to just, okay, and I love this idea that we are coming to, in addition to everything we've said about the soul, the idea of this evolving meaning, the changing identities, and the idea of communities of belonging. We've talked about ethnic identities, and definitely that's very, very racial, ethnic, tribe, if you want to use that word, all of these and tribal, you know, will capture both the race and the ethnic thing. But then also you've brought in the identities, other social identities. So communities, you know, communities around, organized around language, organized if you want around faith, professional communities, gendered communities, generational communities. All of these communities are existing in relation to the nation. And actually nobody is one. I'm not just this, I am this and that and that and that and the other. And what I'm hearing is that there's a way in which the way that those who have access to control over power, state power to the state have tended to play one identity against the other. And particularly the idea of this notion of tribe, especially these pre, if you want, 1963 constitution identities. I want us to come to this idea of the constitution, because it seems to me that where we're heading to is to say we have a diversity of people, we have a diversity of identities, a diversity of communities. At some point, for whatever reason, we know that in 1920, a century ago, we were brought into an entity called a country, right? A colony at that time that became the country that we know. At some point, we became a republic, you know, we became independent. At some point, we became a republic. We began to work towards this vision of a nation, or we became a nation, depending on where different people are standing. Before we start to get to the thing of the number of questions that are already coming up on the chat, I want us to think about why a constitution matters. Because when we talk about BBI, in the end, it is a contention around a constitution. And not just the 2010 constitution, but the idea of a constitution in relation to Kenya. And I think it's on the table already that not every country and not every nation even has a constitution. I think it's one of the ironies of Kenya that our first constitution that ushered us into independence in 1963 was presided over, the draft was given to us by a country that doesn't really have a written constitution. So I want us to just very quickly, because I want us to get to that question, Gala, that you put on the table of what does all of this have to do with the bread and butter issues, if you want, the ugali and sukuma wiki issues, the problems that people are facing. Take me back, you know, each of you say something about our history of constitutions. And let me just first start with, what's a constitution? What does a constitution have to do with the soul of a nation? What does a constitution have to do with this idea of nationhood? Oyunga, who did I start with? Last time I put Wendy on the spot. So this time, Angala, let me start with you.
Yeah.
Constitution, what's all this about a constitution, the soul of the nation, where we want to go in terms of solving our problems?
So it's important to can also pay attention to like the history of constitutional making then in Kenya in particular. One, I always say that the constitution from which much of laws derive from or come from is fundamentally meant to manage relationships. And so therefore, then the question for a particular constitutional experience then becomes, what is the dominant relationship in which that constitution tries to manage? For Kenya and most sort of settler colonies, sometimes we tend to forget that the origins of the Kenyan state were very were based on a patronage relationship, right? So the state was meant to exist so as to advance the interests of a particular class or community within that state's territory. So in this case, white settlers dominated the Kenyan state to advance their interests, throughout the colonial period. And the problem is that in the 1960s, that system was not fundamentally reformed. The idea that the state exists to serve the sectional interest of a particular class, that idea was not fundamentally sort of disturbed during the constitutional deliberations in the 1960s. Now, as Wandia, put it, people had already been socialized to arrive at the state via their identity, right? So that even the sort of discussions that are happening in Lancaster, it was these sort of tribal representatives that had been sent to go and speak on behalf of their so-called or the ethnicities that they claimed to be representing. And no one seemed to have a problem with that, even during that time, right? So what then happens here is that we pick on a sort of legal framework that was supposed to articulate these very ethnic tribal sentiments, right? So for example, Majimbo then becomes one way in which sort of ethnic fears were being articulated through a constitutional position. You know, in this case, the creation of a quasi-federal state, which is what Kenya becomes independent on in 1963, right? So of course it was very clear that to the Kenyan politician and to the Kenyan public, certain provisions of the constitution were supposed to protect the interests of particular emergent communities, right? Which is to also say that the nation had not emerged, right? And that there was a failure of imagination to imagine the state. You're talking about the post-colonial political elite. And this is sort of the original scene, right? Their failure to imagine the state, their failure to even ask the question, should we imagine a nation called Kenya, right? So that when you talk about laws, you talk about constitution, especially in ways in which the constitution organizes the political space, not so much violence had been done to the idea of ethnic organization. Yeah. And that has been the sort of the political development since then. So when you're thinking about devolution, when you're thinking about creation of the post of prime minister, expanding the executive, it's all just a sort of formalistic language that is being used to express very ethnic motivations in this case. And I think that is actually the tragedy of our history of constitutional making in Kenya.